Blog Talk Radio. This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest, L.A. poet, activist, and teacher, Connie Williams. How are you, Connie?
I'm doing extremely well. Thank you for having me on today, Rich.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Connie. I know you're a busy man these days, as we will soon see, Connie Williams is a poet, actor, and performance artist. He has two collections of poetry, Leaves of Spilled Spirit from an Untamed Poet, released in 2002, and Blues Red Soul Falsetto, released last year. He is the artistic director at the World Stage in Leimert Park and coordinator for the Anansi Writers Workshop. Connie, I thought we would start today's show by having you read a poem. How's that sound?
That sounds good, and let's get into it. Okay.
Sounds great.
The night is her second skin, caresses starlight between her breasts. The soft of summer takes refuge in her length as she uncoils, and no one knows her real name. She appeared like creation, declaration of God, perfect verse upon the page. No warning, advance notice, nowhere to safely place my hands, and the surprise between them, insufficient water to hide. She's comprised of only left angles, counterclockwise woman, full of legs, elbows, calculating pace, tenderness. Night melts upon her black salsa gown, lace dripping upon every curve, navel and orbit of her full moons. Night is her hostage, decides when to liberate the darkness. Her eyes, they stalk me, thick, wide, brown as lament. They unearth confessions yet to bear fruit upon my tongue. Her voice is a perfect altar where I ask forgiveness for sins I have yet to commit. I dreamed her upon my pillow, dreamed her like stars over Sedona, breathing faultless. Her presence is a marketplace where friends daybreak together, produce fresh touch. I have forgotten how to hide whenever I smell her laughter, and no one knows her real name. But what does that matter? When she discloses how she was born, she exposes her first scar. I twist, turn like Midwest weather. She is humid upon my face, closer than the fear of desire, digested slowly for the first time. She, balmy, kiss, holy, wait for her with glass eyes, beveled like chance. I don't know how to hide from her. A transparent novel of best-selling pages, always open to the plot for her to read at her discretion. She, however, counts sand, trusting time to sleep in her bed, vulnerability wrapped in her hands, and undressed words boiling inside her stomach. Her lips swell, ripen when she reads poetry. How is this possible when no one knows her given name? So I visit every bookstore, every cafe, listen for her request to end the hush between us. Then I would place my fingers across her cover, her mouth illumination, wish I could whisper into it, crawl inside her body and do my best work, write her poetry like Lucille Clifton. Thank you.
That was beautiful. Her voice is the perfect altar where I ask forgiveness. Man, there were so many beautiful lines in there. And, you know, it's interesting. I think you had a line something like, I twist, I turn like Midwest weather.
Yes.
So timely. They're actually getting slammed with some terrible storms right now, actually.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. I was just reading that. What originally got you into poetry, Connie?
I actually have been writing poetry all my life. I started writing poetry as a youngster. My earliest memories are probably like maybe 6, 7, or 8, something like that. And I did it to stay alive, actually.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, I know you originally hail from Shreveport, Louisiana. I'm also from the South. My mom's from Louisiana, actually. I'm from North Carolina. What aspects of the South, be it certain traditions, beliefs, societal attitudes, would you say play into the creation of your work or your poetic voice or overall creativity?
Vernacular.
Yes.
Vernacular. I love Southern vernacular. I love Southern speak. I love the tone that they use. Sometimes slow, sometimes a drawl, sometimes they chew their words. I love that. They chew their words like a child chews cud, you know. So
nice.
Yeah. I love that.
I hear you. I'm right there with you. You know, a number of times, I've seen you perform live a number of times now, and, you know, there are certain qualities that seem to remain consistent, your stage presence, your dynamic performance. How did you go about developing those skills, or were those things that came naturally to you?
I think they're just kind of part and parcel of who I am. I don't know if I put it in my bio that I sent you, but I'm a former Pentecostal preacher, so.
Nice. Yeah, I actually read about that online. How did you get involved with that?
Well, when I first moved to Los Angeles, my life was very out of control, very undirectional, as I should say. I had no direction, And I joined the church, and it helped me find focus and find some discipline in my life that I had kind of lost or maybe didn't have for a long time in my life, my early youth. And I was a Pentecostal preacher, youth pastor for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
Until I rediscovered my poetry, rediscovered writing, and I started writing again. Yeah, and when I found the world stage, it all changed then. So,
well, why don't we talk about the world stage? Because I know you've done a lot of community involvement, like you just said, but perhaps I would say, at least looking on the outside, some of your greatest community involvement, some of the most profound work you've done is definitely with the World Stage in Leimert Park. How did you originally get involved with the organization?
Wow, I was starting to do poetry again, writing. I ran into some friends of mine who came to a poetry reading that I was at in Pasadena at a Mexican restaurant. Of all places.
Where all good poetry readings should be. Mexican restaurants in Pasadena.
Yeah, Michael Datcher, Janone Adams, and A.K. Tony. They invited me to come to the world stage, and that was about 18 years ago, and I have since. Haven't left.
I remember A.K. Well, I know Michael Datcher very well. He's amazing. And I remember A.K. Tony from years ago. Is he still involved with the world stage?
Oh, absolutely. He was just there this past Wednesday. Not as much. He's a new father now. He has a young son. He's teaching poetry in schools to young people. He still comes around. Mm-hmm. He was actually at our rally that we had about 4 weeks ago. Yeah. So he's
good.
Still comes around. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you
that's what got me at the world stage, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. So you helped to create the Anansi Writers Workshop at the World Stage. What are the workshop's origins, and how would you say it's grown over the years?
Well, Michael Datcher is the creator of how the workshop is right now. When the workshop first started, it was more of a loose gathering together where people just came and read their works and things like that, because the World Stage and the writing workshop has been there from its inception almost 25 years. But Michael added the structure to the workshop, and that's when it began to flourish. The writers
and what is that structure exactly?
That structure is the first hour they have a traditional workshop where people bring their works in progress, and the collective that are gathered there come there to provide feedback. We do writing exercises sometimes, depending upon the time allowed. We have a featured reader, and that's for the first hour. Then for the next 30 minutes, we have a featured reader, and then for the last hour, we have an open reading at the World Stage. So that structure is how our Wednesday night goes at the World Stage. For the
nice.
Writing
Do you ever workshop any of your own poetry there?
Repeat that? I'm sorry.
Do you ever workshop any of your own poetry there?
All the time.
Nice.
Oh, I still do that. Oh, yeah. I tell people it's always good to – it's reading other people's poetry, being around other people who can give you feedback on your poetry is always a way to grow. So I never want to get away from that. So
yeah. So speaking for yourself or for, you know, students you've seen over the years, what do you feel that the workshop experience has to offer when trying to help writers, poets, and other artists grow? And, you know, what are some of the ahas, some of the enlightening moments, and perhaps some of the struggles you've found with this sort of environment?
Well, to me, the workshop at the World Stage is similar to workshops I did in university. I mean, you read someone, you write a particular poem or a type of poem, and you come back to class, and your fellow students provide feedback. they give you some affirmation, and they give you some critique. You know, as far as about your poem, what they may have liked, maybe what they didn't like, and maybe some ways to improve. The teacher maybe provides that. And that's basically what happens at the World Stage. We try to affirm the work, let people know what we think we feel is working and not working, then provide some critique. But we also let the people know that it's your poem, because everybody has different writing goals when they come to the World Stage. And we never try to box anyone into a particular corner in the sense of saying this is the way that it needs to go. Some people only want to write for personal satisfaction. Some people want to write for their family and their friends. And some people want to be published. And, you know, so you have to balance all of those different needs, wants, desires of people who come there and attend. I think one of the biggest ahas is that a lot of people don't want to have their work critiqued today. Everybody, you know, the thing that sort of bothers me today is a lot of people don't read other poets. And they just want to get on a microphone and regurgitate, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's important to be around other writers, because I think that being around other writers is a benefit for you. There's an old saying down south saying that iron sharpens iron, you know what I mean?
Right.
Around other good writers, they're going to provoke you, stir you. You know, when you're listening to another poet that you admire, appreciate, and you hear them, it can inspire you to write something, to raise your game, so to speak. You know, you want to, you know, get better. You want to grow. You want to, you know. So to me, that's the beautiful part of gathering together and doing that type of work is encouraging, inspiring one another to grow and to be the best you want to be for whatever goal it is that you want to have.
Yeah. So the workshops, you know, as you mentioned before, 25 years and strong. I mean, that's a long time. What do you think has sustained the workshop for so long?
Well, I think that it's balancing the needs of the community, of the people who attend, and our community is large. It's it doesn't just incorporate the Leimert Park area. We have people that attend from across the city that come to the workshop. And I think the sustainability of the workshop is that we want to encourage people to find your voice, your truest self, to be honest. We have the what we say at the World State, the no BS rule. you know, to be honest, to tell the truth. Because to me, that's one of the first places for me in writing poetry is to start, is to be honest, whatever it is that you're writing about. And that doesn't mean about being confessional. That just means about being honest about whatever it is that you're trying to convey. And that's been a staple of our workshop. And I think that that's helped it to be able to continue. And we've always had an influx of people coming and going, and different people that have run the workshop. So all of those things have contributed to its survival, and I'm grateful for that.
Do you ever get, I guess this would sort of be filed under maybe success story. Do you ever get people coming back to you that maybe took the workshop some years ago and are just like, you know, thank you so much for that experience. You really helped my writing, or you really helped some aspect of my life.
I'll just speak of a person that we probably both know, Billy Burgos, will tell you that
yes.
Most of the poems that he has in his collection of poet Eulogy to a Tree were birthed, were nurtured, were all of that were those things were done writing the Anansi Writers Workshop. I mean,
nice.
Billy was a big part of that before he moved on to start doing all of the wonderful things that he's doing in the poetry community now. But most of those poems were done right there at the workshop.
So
it happens all the time.
good. As I pretty much figured it would. For people listening that might want to check out the workshop, I believe you said it's Wednesday nights. What time?
It starts at 7:30 every Wednesday night at the World Stage, 4344 Degnan Boulevard in historical Leimert Park Boulevard. You can also check us out at the worldstage.org. And from our website, you'll see a calendar of events, and it'll give you a rundown of who our features are and upcoming will be. And
nice.
We also have a Facebook page as well.
Nice. What are some of the other programs currently offered at the World Stage? I know you have a lot of music.
It's a lot. It's a lot that goes on there. We have a drumming workshop on Monday nights. They have a vocal workshop on Tuesday nights. They have a women's drum circle early Thursday evening. And then later Thursday evening, they have a jam session where musicians of all skill levels come out and jam and play together. And then on the weekend, they have jazz. And they have a jazz ensemble that gathers on Saturday mornings, and they have another jam session on Sundays. And so it's a lot going on. We also have youth programming during the daytime, so during the weekdays. So, it's a lot going on.
Speaking of music and jazz, I mean, one of my favorite drummers, I believe he had a Billy Higgins. I believe he has a great history with the World Stage. What is his involvement with what was his involvement with the World Stage, even though his legacy still carries on?
Right. Billy Higgins and the legendary jazz drummer and master poet and community activist Kamal Daoud were the brainchild behind the beginning of the World Stage. They wanted a place where artists could come and have the freedom to work on their craft and their skills and work with other artists and just have the freedom to be able to do it in a space that was safe, you know. And they started this place 25 years ago, and their mantra has always been seeking light through sound,
sound,
whether it's music or through the word, you know, and that's how the World Stage evolved. And Billy has passed on now, but Kamal is still alive and still loves and cares for the World Stage, although he's not there for the day-to-day operations and things that go on. But they are the reason the World Stage is here. and they were just they're just wonderful, wonderful people to have done what they did to bring this about and bring it to the community.
Yeah, I one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show, and besides just wanting to, you know, touch base with you again and hear your work, and to also offer some context for the world stage, is I know that, you know, you guys are undergoing a little bit of crisis right now with some of the problems facing the world stage, and I was hoping you could give the listeners a little bit of history on what's going on and what you've been doing to sort of fight for the world stage and where things currently stand.
Well, what is currently going on is there's going to be a new metro station in the Leimert Park area, something that has been fought for by the Leimert Park community. I want to mention the person who's been spearheading that. His name is Damian Goodman, a young brother who cares so much about the Leimert Park area. Our desire was to have a metro stop there, although it was initially denied. And after a three-year battle to get the metro stop to come there, and our desire to have it there was to bring capital and to bring into the area. I mean, the Leimert Park area could certainly use an infusion of capital to help the area, to bring more attention to the area, and hopefully increase business foot traffic in that particular area. However, has been the case in every situation where there's a metro stop, property values escalate, and a lot of times get real estate people who will come in, buy up the property, and completely change the area from what it once was. We saw that happen in North Hollywood. So we're hoping that does not happen to the world stage. However, there is a cloud hanging over us because we don't know what's going to happen. A person has come and bought up the building that is where the world stage is. We don't know who that person is, although the person purchased this building back in May of this year. They have not spoken to us in the sense of letting us know what their intentions are. They've been somewhat onerous in the sense of the way that they are conducting their business when they initially started. I do want to be clear that the world stage does not have an imminent eviction hanging over us. However, I try to explain to people that the way real estate people do today, they don't necessarily want to go to eviction because of the legal issues that are involved with that. They prefer to keep individuals on month-to-month leases and just not renew the lease. It just makes it a lot easier to be able to get rid of people. So that's what our status is right now. We don't know what's happening. So what we're working towards is raising the profile of the world stage, the work that is done in the community. We're hoping for designation, but we're also hoping if that doesn't happen, Rich, is to have our own space that we can own, that we can have ownership of, so that this type of issue never becomes an issue for us ever again. Certainly, we would love to stay in Leimert Park. This is our home. This is where we would love to be. But we realize that if that is not the case, that we want a space where we can continue to do the things that we've been doing for the past 25 years, that we can have ownership of. If there's a designation made and we can maintain our status there and be able to continue to do the things that we do and grow the things that we do, that would be optimal for us to continue that in the Leimert Park area. However, we
absolutely
are seeking to just have a space that we can have ownership of. That's our goal.
Have you been on the lookout for other spaces in Leimert Park or the general area that you could perhaps move into if you get forced out at any given point?
We have been looking, and we've been talking to a few people. We've actually been offered one particular location that have already said that would be a possibility for us moving there. But our first and foremost desire is to maintain and to be able to stay in the Leimert Park area where we are and grow from where we are as well.
Yes. Because really where you are now is such a lovely space. It's such a lovely little area, that whole strip of Degnan.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and why don't you read another poem for us?
Okay. The first poem I read was a new poem that I've written, but I'll read a poem from my latest collection, Blues Riff Soul Falsetto. It's called A Coward in Parents' Clothing. I hate me on weekends because I do not believe I am a good father. I love you, but not myself. My tears or morning after pills that prevent faith from conceiving a non-compliant dad's debut. Nor can pity grant my penis amnesty. I wish I had the kiss of mother's hands so delirious, ripe with the voice of versatile fingers. They are a womb of forgiveness. 18 months in, I am doubting custody, visitation, diapers, doubting my patience to guide you through nostalgia, accelerated technology, through nights of imminent masturbation. December 2003, she says, ain't nothing to worry about. I wasn't ready for red storm, nursery rhymes, driving 4 freeways to get within burping distance to hear your daddy speak, recall my resident weakness. There are no mirrors at my house to cast this father's reflection, so I apologize to grandchildren you will bring home for Christmas, because today what you require seems exorbitant, and my courage is napalmed. But my greatest fear is that you will hate me for writing this poem. Thank you.
Wow. Wow. You know, that was powerful. You know, your first poetry collection, Leaves of Spilled Spirit from an Untamed Poet, which was released in... What's that?
Yes, I'm disagreeing with you.
Oh, yeah. It was first released in 2002, and then, you know, your most recent collection from which you just read, Blues Red Soul Falsetto. I get the impression that your most recent collection deals with certain societal and personal issues in a more, how shall I say, a more sort of determined, in-depth, and unabashed way than perhaps your first collection did. And I'm hoping you could share some thoughts about your first collection, share some of its themes, and in what way those themes and issues might have changed when bringing together the poems for your most recent collection.
Yeah, my first collection was basically poems about relationship, between lovers, between family, between friends. And it was a book that basically that got into talking about the different dynamics that work in relationships: good, bad, love, hurt, hope, all of those different things. The difficulties of having platonic friends. So that's where the first book went. Whereas in the second book, it deals with life and our relationship to each other, to the issues that we face each and every day, pertinent issues of being a parent, of being a citizen in the United States of America, being a black man. It touches on all of those different themes. And the idea is it has an undertone of blues because that's my background of growing up in Shreveport. It's blue. And the beauty of that blue, the sorrow of that blue, the hope of that blue, in and throughout. But it really goes into depth into a lot of issues facing us in society. As individuals, yeah. as we try to traverse this journey that we walk on, yeah.
Yeah, that was extremely beautiful what you just said. You know, you mentioned something just before about Well, I'm going to just sort of paraphrase some thoughts. The beauty of the blue, the sorrow of the blue, and then you also mentioned something about being a black man in the United States, and that kind of touches upon something. You know, I was on your website and read a piece entitled Twilight, which kind of addresses that topic, and I was extremely moved by it, and I was hoping you could read it.
Yeah, it was sort of like an op-ed thing that I wrote. So I'll read it. Here we go.
Great.
All right. This is called Twilight. It is twilight in America, the time of living when it is most difficult for the sincerest of individuals to see injustice. Black injustice, clearly see it, face like a plump, soft, out-of-shape neighborhood watchman as the perpetuation of white supremacy. See it as soccer moms who bake Rice Krispie treats and sit on juries that don't convict murderers of black boys who are unable to defend themselves, which is impossible to do when you're left in a morgue freezer for several days, unidentified, although your identification is in your front pocket. Even if your death is videotaped by numerous onlookers on a train platform, while those who are trained to assassinate guiltless black males with impunity confess to doing so, but request absolution because they didn't realize that black males were on the endangered species list. It's way past winter, Gil. Past the perfectly cold season that has the ability to chill the spread of this infection. Not even the CDC has a vault that could adequately freeze, maintain, and isolate this uniquely American disease. Black males continue to feel the basic instinct of trying to run for cover, desperately seeking asylum in America. But if such a place truly existed, don't you think that we would have found it by now? After more than 500 years of running, sadly, there is no safety to run to, even though black men know how to run well, because this has been the easiest thing for us to do. No safe haven run, no legislation powerful enough to safety black men from targets tattooed upon our chests, into our psyche. No, not even the DNA of black babies is safe, so run. So black men continue to run, but not for our lives. We have come to understand that running for our lives would be the most foolish thing we could ever do. This is because our lives would have to have infinitely more value if we're going to try and save it. So we cannot run for our lives, because what is the value of a black man in America? 41 shots, 11 months, or a not guilty verdict? When does the milk carton campaign begin for black males? When will anthropologists stop digging up our bones from the cold pavements of states like Florida? Truth be told, the black man in America has never had a chance to grow, to flourish. I know what critics will say. Look at how iron has entered into the black man's soul and what he has accomplished, in spite of it being hunting season upon black males since we were first transplanted here. Look at his successes in music, athletics, and gaze upon the fact that we have a black man presently in the whitest house in America. Every black Moses born into this system of survival has had to be hid, protected from the sheriff of white supremacy, who, whenever the ebony seedling is born into this world, says to kill it before it grow. And this should become the clarion of every black mother across this country. Don't allow another black male to enter into this desperation. Black males running from what can never be eluded or protected from. fear so palpable that it is the garment we dress our little black boys in before we send them off to learn that they will never be valued. Abort black males before they can become enslaved on 21st century plantations, for-profit prisons, maimed, genetically altered, exploited, or bloodlet, because it is twilight in America. It is twilight in America, the time of living when it is most difficult for the sincerest of individuals to see injustice, black injustice, clearly. Thank you, Rich.
Wow. Wow. So I believe you said before you read the piece that this was an op-ed piece. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did you write the piece in reaction to a particular issue or a certain situation?
I wrote it right after the Trayvon Martin decision
in
Florida. Yeah, I wrote it right after.
Well, yeah. You know, speaking of Florida, you know, like you, I'm from the South, you know, and, you know, I was from, as I said earlier, I was, as a child, I spent a number of years in North Carolina, and, you know, the divisions of race were fairly pronounced. And, you know, when I got to LA in the early 90s, you know, it didn't seem that, you know, as divided. Things seemed a bit more open-minded and fluid as far as, you know, racial equality and acceptance, you know, and then came the LA riots where, you know, and some of my original thinking, I, you know, was perhaps a bit naive, but then, you know, the LA riots came along and kind of blew the lid off that to some degree. And it's just like, wow, we still have a lot of haves and have-nots, you know. And I'm curious about your thoughts, you know, because you're from the South, how you've seen, you know, those divisions of race and how they compare to here in a place like Los Angeles.
It's certainly different here in Los Angeles. You know, I grew up my early years in Louisiana, and I lived in a neighborhood where half the neighborhood was black and half the neighborhood was white, and we couldn't even walk down the street in our own neighborhood that was part of our own neighborhood, you know, in a certain direction. We had to stay on our side of the street. So it was very blatant, very in your face, the way that I grew up and the way that I faced and saw racism. In California, it's a lot more subtle.
Yes, it is.
It's a lot more subtle. It's more nuanced. If that's a good word to apply to racism and the way that it works, the way that it works here, I worked for the city of Los Angeles. I just recently retired from there, but one of the things I told my friends, I told them when I used to have dreadlocks. And I told my friends that once I grew my dreadlocks, I knew that I would never get another promotion on my job. I knew
right.
that. But it was something that I felt I needed to do for myself. And I never got another promotion in the last 13 years of my employment there. And I'm not going to sit here and say that it was necessarily all about my dreadlocks. That would be that would not be true. But
right.
I know that it played a big part in my ability to be able to promote on my job when previous to that, I had promoted probably 6 to 8 times throughout my career prior
wow.
to me growing my dreadlocks. So in the first 18 years, I probably had 6 to 8 promotions, and in my last 12, I didn't have any after I grew my dreadlocks. So in California, the racism is a lot more subtle. You know, and you mentioned the riots and talk about that. That's when the world stage really began to flourish in 1992. I mean, that really, really, really put the world stage on the map, because during that time, that's where people came to talk about things that were happening, things that were going on, and we see them still continuing. I mean, you know, with people like Oscar Grant and different people that have been killed and murdered out here in California. I mean, black and brown people are constantly, as I say, under a neighborhood watch, so to speak.
Right.
Constantly being questioned, constantly being challenged and looked at askance because of the color of our skin. So it's not as in your face as the way I grew up, but it still exists. And it's something that I pray, I don't have much hope of, but I hope it's eradicated before I pass. Pass on.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. You know, when we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to address this one area before we part ways. You know, when you get to your website, there are these words that greet the visitor. Where the soul is undressed, the spirit laid bare, and honesty and truth are the garments with which the heart is spoken. I love those words. It just brought the question to my mind. What are some of the ways you feel that you best speak your honesty and truth?
It's by the way you live your life. That's the best way. Words fall to the ground, and they lose their meaning if there is not a person, a life behind what you say and what you do. And I've worked and I continue to work, strive every day to be a better human being every day. That is my desire. That is my goal, to be a better father, a better brother, a better friend. I want to be a better human being. I'm not sure of the name of the poet who said it, and I've heard it quoted many times, and I wish I did. They said that, you know, that we should leave this world more beautiful than we found it.
Yeah.
That's certainly my mission statement. I was just sharing this with a friend yesterday. I said, I don't know which poet said that, but I do know that Earth, Wind, and Fire took that statement and coined it in their own way when Maurice White said, if you don't see no beauty, then make some beauty. If you don't see beauty, if you don't see any beauty, Rich, then make some beauty. And I think that that's each of our responsibility while we're here. Where there's ugliness, where there's blight, where there's hurt, and where there's pain, we should be making beauty. And we have the capacity, we have the ability to do that. That's how we speak the truth, is by making beauty. And we do that by the way that we care and the way we live our lives, the way we help others along this journey. That's how I do it. It has to have a life behind it. It can't just be words.
Wow. Yes, that was quite well spoken. I was just trying to find the person who mentioned that. I think it was... a gentleman named Robert Baden-Powell.
Thank you.
who might have originally coined that phrase,
great.
Leave this world a little better than you found it. That was,
absolutely,
his last message.
Wow.
Interesting. Yeah.
Isn't that it's a great statement.
It really is, and I love how you summed it up for your own life. Connie, what's the best way for people to find out about, you mentioned the world stage before, how people can check it out, but mention again, what's the best way for people to find out about you, your poetry, and about the world stage?
You can find out about me on my website, which is conniewilliams.com. You can find out about me on the world stage, theworldstage.org. And you can also check me out on Facebook, Connie Williams.
Cool.
Connie B. Williams on Facebook. I would love to for you to be my friend. So check it
do
out.
Do you have any do you have any shows coming up?
I don't right now, not before the end of the year. But I'm hoping to do something real soon. But just finished doing a few things just recently, but I don't have anything coming up right away. I'm actually working in the city where I live here in the city of Downey. Working with a very wonderful woman over here, Lorraine Parks, who we're working to get some additional things with poetry up and going over here. So just continue to work in the community and to give back, because it's so very, very important for us to do that.
Nice, nice. And actually, real quick, before we part ways, I know you've got a couple new projects you're working on. Maybe you could briefly mention those. You've got a – well, actually, why don't you go ahead and talk about what you're working on? I know you're working on a poetry collection and a novel.
I'm working on a poetry collection about Cuba, hoping to finish that. I don't know when I'll finish it, or either project for that matter, but working on a project of some poems about Cuba. I love it. I'm hoping to go back there so I can do some more. I was there last year and just was completely blown away by the place. And I'm also working on a novel called The Art of Breathing.
Beautiful.
About learning to live this life on your own, learning to live this life on your own without the necessity of accoutrements and stuff like that. So The Art of Breathing. So two different projects, a novel and my first novel, actually, that I'm working on in this collection of poetry about Cuba. So those are the two projects that I have going right now.
Well, all the best with those. And Connie Williams, thank you again for being on the show, and I wish you all the best with the world stage and with your own work.
Thank you so much, Rich. I appreciate being here today. It's been absolutely wonderful, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be critically acclaimed poet, educator, and slam poetry master, Jeffrey McDaniel. Jeffrey has a new collection out entitled Chapel of Inadvertent Joy, so I'm sure we'll be talking about all that and so much more. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.